attacks against Palestinians is necessary to protect regional stability and prevent further deterioration of the situation. He also rejected any possibility for Hamas fighters in Rafah to lay down their arms. Bahram said the movement's fighters in Rafah will not accept surrender or hand over their weapons, no matter how intense the aggression becomes. Investigative journalist Rick Sterling joined us earlier to discuss why Israel continues to obstruct the Gaza ceasefire deal with Hamas despite international criticism.
Well, first and foremost, I think we need to be clear that the Palestinians have the right to resist, and Hamas's refusal to lay down their arms is only right. They recognize that if they were to lay down their arms, it would lead to more bloodshed, not less. Just recall what happened in the early 1980s when the PLO left Beirut, and that was soon followed by the Sabra and Shatila massacres, where thousands of Palestinians were murdered in cold blood. I think it's very clear that the Palestinians have the right to resist under the UN Charter and under Protocol 1 of the Geneva Convention. So the claims that Israel keeps making that that they're fighting terrorism, they're standing truth on their on its head. And it was very good to see recently where the newly elected president of Ireland, Catherine Connolly, has said explicitly that Israel is a terrorist state. And that is the reality of the matter. Since the first day of the current ceasefire in Gaza, October 11, Israel has killed at least 345 Palestinians. They have wounded 889. That works out to an average of 7 deaths per day.
Israeli forces continue to kill more Palestinian civilians across the Gaza Strip as the regime presses ahead with its blatant violations of the ceasefire deal. Gaza's health ministry reported 3 more deaths as a result of Israel's attacks on Sunday. According to Palestinian sources, nearly 360 civilians have been killed since the ceasefire entered into force in October. The death toll from the regime's genocide now surpasses 70,100. Our Gaza correspondent, Moti Abu Musabe, joined us earlier with more details on the regime's truce violations.
Every single part of Gaza Strip, particularly the eastern outskirts of Gaza's districts, are still witnessing more cruel attacks of the Israeli occupation forces. Over the past couple of hours, the Israeli occupation forces in the eastern side of Khan Yunis City intensified their artillery strikes against Beni Suhaila Aya. As you know, that this Aya is still witnessing daily attacks by the Israeli occupation forces. The Israeli warplanes have launched dozens of their strikes against this Aya per se, coupled with the extensive artillery strikes. In the meantime, more essential buildings were detonated and destroyed by the Israeli occupation forces in the eastern side of Gaza City. Needless to mention that the situation right now in the eastern side of Rafah City is absolutely indescribable, because the Israeli occupation forces for the past couple of weeks have been intensifying their air raids against the eastern sides and neighborhoods of the city, which were absolutely obliterated and destroyed by the Israeli occupation forces. The Israeli army claimed that it has succeeded to unalive and kill several Palestinian militants and fighters from the Al-Qassam brigades, including multiple, as you know, military leaders. And one of them was the son of Dr. Ghazi Hamad, the member of the political bureau of Hamas movement.
Meanwhile, Israel presses ahead with its land grab policy across the occupied West Bank. In the latest development, the regime has seized more than 250 acres of Palestinian land in a village south of Tubas. According to Palestinian media, Israeli officials issued new demolition orders targeting homes and farms in the village of Atuf, east of Tamun, in the southern Tubas area. Israeli forces have delivered notices to a number of families in the village, giving them 7 days to leave their facilities. The orders came about 2 weeks after the confiscation of roughly around 247 acres of land owned by the residents of Tamun, Tubas and Khirbet Yarza. That land is reportedly intended for a settlement road planned to run from east of Nablus to a checkpoint in eastern Tubas. Local outlets say during the past week, Israel seized an additional 257 acres of Palestinian-owned land in Tubas and northern Jordan Valley through 9 separate confiscation orders. Our West Bank correspondent Nikar Hamad joined us earlier with the latest updates on the ongoing Israeli raids across the occupied territory. Let's see what she had to say.
Today, the Israeli forces have continued their demolition operations that have started yesterday inside Jenin refugee camp. Whatever is left from Jenin refugee camp, another 24 homes of Palestinian homes have received notifications of demolition on the edges of Jenin refugee camp under the pretenses of security measurements. And unfortunately, today, the Israeli forces have completed the demolitions of these 24 homes inside Jenin refugee camp. In Tul Kerem, Mahdi, as you have mentioned, the Israeli forces have started making new infrastructure that is, of course, infrastructure to serve the military purposes inside the city and inside the refugee camps of Tul Kerem and Nur Shams. It's for sure not an infrastructure for the Palestinians or for the Palestinian civilians who were forcibly displaced from their homes, but as infrastructure for those Israeli forces who obviously intend to stay inside these refugee camps, making permanent outposts inside the refugee camp. Until now, there is no further information about whether some of the Palestinians will be allowed to go back into their homes.
Hundreds of protesters have gathered outside the Israeli president's residence to oppose Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's request for a pardon in his ongoing corruption trial. Protesters argued that what Netanyahu is asking for is not a pardon. They said the Israeli Prime Minister is actually asking that his trial over corruption cases be completely cancelled without taking any responsibility and without paying the price. Demonstrators stressed that they will not accept Netanyahu's pardon because he is guilty. Netanyahu, who faces long-standing corruption charges, has submitted a formal request for a pardon to President Isaac Herzog. He is facing 3 corruption cases, including bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. Netanyahu is also wanted by the Hague-based International Criminal Court over charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza. Iran's president has called for further strengthening of relations and strategic cooperation amongst Islamic countries, emphasizing that it would prevent foreign powers from meddling in Muslims' affairs. Pezeshkian was speaking in a meeting with Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan in Tehran. He said part of the regional crises is a result of plots hatched by some interventionist parties that seek to sow discord in the region. He stressed that such parties seek to impose their wrong policies on the region and obstruct the development and progress of Islamic nations. Pezeshkian expressed hope that Islamic countries would cooperate with one another and avoid making existing issues more complicated. Before meeting with the president, Fidan held talks with several senior Iranian officials, including Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Qalibaf, and top security official Ali Larijani. During his meeting with Araghchi, both counterparts described Israel as the greatest threat to the region's security and stability.
Countries have mutual concerns. The issue of Palestine and cooperation between the two countries with the aim of ending the massacre of Palestinians in Gaza was on the agenda of the talks. Repeated violations by Israel in Gaza and Israeli attacks in Lebanon and Syria show that this regime has bigger plans to destabilize the region.
Regarding Israeli aggression in the region, this is a mutual problem for all of us. The ceasefire in Gaza must continue, and attacks in the West Bank must stop. We believe that, with regard to the situation in Syria and the expansion of Israeli aggression in the region, the international community must fulfill the responsibilities that rest upon its shoulders.
Also, Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi emphasized Tehran's role as a reliable energy supplier for Turkey, announcing readiness to expand economic cooperation with Ankara. For his part, the Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan stressed that his country has always stood by Iran and will continue to do so. Fidan, called for the removal of unjust sanctions against Iran. The Israeli regime suffered a heavy blow during its 12-day aggression against Iran, but the severity of the damages has been brought to light recently, indicating the impact was more severe than previously thought. More in this episode of The Explainer. Let's take a look.
The 12-day Israeli aggression against Iran was one of the greatest defeats the Israeli regime suffered in its fabricated history. According to some confessions from American and Israeli sources, this aggression was the result of a 20-year plan to attack Iran, which resulted in the defeat of the Israeli regime. The regime is now at its weakest point when it comes to attacking Iran. The wave of Iranian attacks on Israel has led the regime to resort to severe censorship. In a recent report referring to the Iranian attacks, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz revealed that some of the locations targeted by Iranian missiles were not announced by Tel Aviv, and some researchers have revealed them using satellite images. The newspaper wrote that from the beginning of the war to the end, Iran fired a total of about 530 ballistic missiles in 42 waves, totaling 1,000 with drones. These attacks caused great damage to the Israeli regime. Data from the Israeli Tax Administration indicate that since the beginning of the war with Iran, more than 41,000 damage cases have been registered, of which approximately 33,000 were related to damages to residential homes, 4,100 to vehicles, and more than 4,000 to property and equipment. The Israeli Tax Authority estimated the initial cost of residential damage at $1.3 billion, which is expected to exceed $1.5 billion. During this time, more than 18,000 people were forced to evacuate their homes, and the cost of emergency housing and services for them was estimated at about $500 million. It should be noted that the damage to Israeli regime's buildings, especially security and military buildings, is not included in this report and is not included in this process. Meanwhile, economic analysts estimate the direct and indirect costs of this war for Israel at between $20 to $40 billion, a figure that includes military spending, missile defense, destruction of economic activities, damage from Iranian attacks, and reconstruction costs. According to Hebrew media, Israel's average daily military spending during this period was about $725 million, totaling to $8.7 billion, of which more than $2.5 billion was spent on the Israeli defense system. On the other hand, the economic disruption caused by widespread business closures and the paralysis of the tourism, tech, transportation, and daily service sectors caused losses of $1.5 billion daily, totaling about $18 billion in the 12-day period. The economic toll of the Israeli aggression against Iran and the genocidal war in Gaza may cost Israel an estimated $400 billion in lost economic activity over the next decade. Also, according to the regime's media, Iranian missiles and its attacks caused about $3 billion in direct damage to infrastructure, including the Haifa oil refinery, the Weizmann Institute, and military buildings in Tel Aviv, the reconstruction of which requires a heavy and multifold budget. This all proves how the Israeli regime's dream of defeating was met with a crushing blow from Iran and its missiles.
The Venezuelan president has condemned Washington's aggression against Caracas, saying the U.S. plans to seize Venezuela's vast oil reserves through military force. Nicolas Maduro made the remarks in a letter to the Secretary General and member states of the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC.
Secretary General, OPEC countries, non-OPEC countries, and OPEC Plus. Venezuela formally denounces before this body that the government of the United States of America intends to take control of Venezuela's vast oil reserves, the largest on the planet, through the use of lethal military force against the territory, the people, and the institutions of the country. This claim not only contradicts the provisions governing peaceful coexistence between nations, but also seriously endangers the stability of Venezuelan oil production and the world's market.
In his letter, Nicolas Maduro asserted that Venezuela will remain firm in the defense of its natural and energy resources and will not succumb to any type of blackmail or threat. His letter came after U.S. President Donald Trump warned on Saturday that the Venezuelan airspace would be completely shut down. Trump also announced that the U.S. will very soon take action against Venezuela on land following over 20 military attacks at sea that have killed at least 83 people since September. We earlier talked to our correspondent Gladys Quesada to get an update on the rising tensions between Venezuela and the U.S. Let's see what she had to say.
Today, the president of the National Assembly, Jorge Rodriguez Gomez, he was also saying that the Venezuelan airspace is only an issue of the Venezuelan people, and the Venezuelan resources are under the patrimony of the Venezuelan people. So this is one of the defenses or one of the ways to shield Venezuelan resources from this kind of attack and this kind of threat by the U.S. Also, I have to say that regarding the airspace of Venezuela and the situation, I know there's a lot of concern from outside Venezuela. In social media, people is constructing the narrative of empty airports and no flights coming in or going out of Venezuela. But the truth is that even though the number is not as large as it used to, there is not only passengers going there, there are also cargo planes coming to the airport, and I was at the airport, at Mike Dia, Simón Bolívar International Airport today, and I had the opportunity to see a Cargo Supre airplane. So there is not only, passengers going to Copa Airlines, for example, there is also these kind of flights that are coming in with resources that also are bringing to Venezuela merchandise, goods, and other pressing, needs for the Venezuelan people. So, moreover, that's the current situation.
With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care, and bye-bye for now.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Good morning. Welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints with me, Atta, the host of this program. Shaykh Hussain Latifi is back with us. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
How was your Hajj pilgrimage?
Alhamdulillah. I remembered you.
Lucky you, man. Yeah. Thank you. I hope that you keep us in your du'as over there.
I did.
And may Allah accept us. And Sister Zainab, assalamu alaikum to you too.
Walaikum salam, brother.
What about you? Have you ever been to Mecca?
I have not been to Mecca.
Okay, Mina, me too. Okay, inshallah, one day. That's right. So that's a wish for everyone to be in Mecca, house of Allah, and pay visit over there, inshallah. Okay. Despite decades of severe international sanctions, Iran has made significant homegrown advancements in key fields, with women, of course, playing in the pivotal role. And Iran's achievements under sanctions and the role of Muslim women is a topic for today's discussion. All right. So I think no country was under sanctions more than Iran throughout the history of the world, okay? So for more than 45 years, we are under severe sanctions and the harshest sanctions from the Western world. But we have so many achievements in various fields. So let's go one by one. Sister Zainab, give us some numbers and statistics regarding different fields.
Okay, well, let's just see. I'll start just with a general stat, which is actually on, which I found interesting, number of university students since the Islamic Revolution. So it's increased tenfold since 1979. Okay. So I thought, well, that's
all right.
So I'm not going to go into all the different sorts of sanctions that there have been, because there's a big list. But what the people tend to say is that there were the less severe sanctions, if you can call it that, up until 2006. And then after 2006, it's a change into the really severe sanctions. But what's interesting is that they were trying to obviously, impact the, for example, the gasoline production in Iran. But now, in the last 10 years, not only is Iran self-sufficient, it's also a gasoline exporter.
Yes.
So things like this. And obviously, Iran has also joined other sort of global groupings, such as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization,
yes.
BRICS. Has bilateral relationships with China and Russia. So all these things are really important.
So
but then...
Okay.
So should also mention some of the things that have happened in the field of what the women have contributed,
mm-hmm.
some of the progress.
Shall we get back to that for the women roles? Okay. So in terms of the universities, you know, more than 60% of the entrants of the university are ladies now. So once in Iran, as I could vividly remember, a kid has to travel from south of Iran to the north of Iran to get the university, okay? Now, in every province of Iran, there is a good university with good professors. Sometimes the students, has to migrate from Tehran to the other cities in order to pursue knowledge, a specific field of study over there. For instance, the faculty of the natural sciences of Gorgan, you know, in the Golestan province, you know, our northern part of Iran, which is the verdant green part of Iran, has the best universities over there. Mm-hmm. Even some of the faculty members of the universities are coming from east of Asia, Malaysia or something like that, okay, to be employed over there. So Shiraz, Isfahan, you know, even Sistan, Balochistan, okay, well, you know, they have good universities. Qom, you know, in terms of the theology and the religious science, has the best universities, faculties all across Iran. So now even knowledge inside Iran is not limited to Tehran, the capital, as used to be at the Taghut time, okay? So everybody has to migrate to Tehran in order to pursue knowledge. The knowledge is spread everywhere. Sheikh Hussein, so what about other achievements in various fields, just name?
Well, actually, one thing that attracted my focus last night when I was going through some of the data, there are two books published in this. It is called The 40-Year Climb, Saud Chilsele, okay?
Oh, by Mr. Raji.
Okay.
Mr. Raji, the Sayyid, that's right.
And all of the statistics are taken from foreigners, like internationally authoritative sources, not Iranians gloating and boasting about themselves. And these two books are very good because this is a counter mean in order to respond to the kind of propaganda that is going on against Iranians. You know, we talked about the hybrid war in another episode. They sanction you and they blame you for the problems that are created by sanctions that they have created.
Okay.
There's this book by Richard Nephew, The Art of Sanctions.
Uh-huh.
In a very diplomatic and nice language, he says basically how they can bring a nation into its knees by sanctions. How sanctions are tools in order to suppress a nation, to, in a way, they said crippling sanctions, right?
Okay.
To cripple a nation,
yes.
Especially the people,
yes.
To change the decision-making process of the politicians in that area.
So that they protest against their own system. That's
so
right.
Under all of these pressures that started from the moment that Imam Khomeini started the revolution, one statistic that, as I said, attracted my attention was this, that, you know, the population of Iran has somehow tripled. Because at the beginning of the revolution, Iran was 35 million.
Yeah.
And now we are close to 90 million.
Yeah.
Okay? So almost tripled. Population has tripled, but GDP per capita has been grown four times.
All right.
No? So it shows that the growth of the population, that not only it did not affect negatively, but also... in a way that Iranian, with proper management, because something that they want to indoctrinate people of the East is that you cannot manage yourself. You cannot help without our help. Okay, you cannot do stuff without the Western management. But Iranians, with their revolution, showed it not only without your involvement, under your sanctions, under all the efforts they made on international level to isolate Iran.
All right.
And politically, they tried all the means that they had to isolate Iran. But now you see people in capitals of the West, they chant Mark Bar Israel in Farsi, isn't it?
All right.
So they, because the message that Iran had, the revolution of Iran, was a message that was in line with the humanity.
Right.
We do not accept injustice. We do not accept oppression. As the Imam said, no East, no West, true independence of the country. So this is politically now, as the sister said, they tried to isolate Iran in different ways, but then there are different international bodies that Iran is an active part in. And they know, for example, in the Middle East, they cannot have anything, they cannot do anything without the participation or cooperation with Iran.
All right.
Despite the thing that they want to say, no, Iran is insignificant. No, Iran has a role, and you cannot just overlook its role in the region.
All right.
And global level.
That's right. So in terms of the sport.
Oh, the medals.
Yeah, the medals. You know, we are happy with our volleyball team, wrestling team, okay? So we topped first. Higher than the U.S. And so many other countries, okay?
In terms of the filmmaking industry, I forgot to say that Iran is the only Muslim nation that has a full circle of filmmaking industry.
Okay.
Like the productions, without the help of the other, like, for other example, language. You have Yusuf Nabiullah.
Yes.
The series has been broadcasted, on different occasions in different Muslim countries. Even in Hamas, they would broadcast it for their captives. Have you heard of this?
Yes. And the nanotechnology, we are the fourth in the world.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, this is really...
Laser technology
Yeah, laser technology. When we are talking about the sanctions, you know, we are not talking about today or tomorrow. More than 45 years we are under sanctions, and the Stan Nano Platforms, you know, says that 300 companies actively are producing nanoproducts and exported to 50 we can say countries, including the U.S. itself, is among the buyers, okay, through the intermediaries. And in terms of the aerospace and biotechnology and the pharmaceuticals, you know, that's right, is top.
Some of the scientific advancements there actually are the counter effect of the sanctions. Ask me how. Because sanctions would stop us, alhamdulillah, to be a milking cow. If there was
really,
if you could have sold oil,
yes,
you would not develop industries.
Okay.
Because you would only rely on the oil that you're producing, and you would have, like the other milking cows.
Mm-hmm.
That is why the leader had said in some occasions that sanctions, they have positive effects as well, because they force you to be self-sufficient. They force you not to rely on your natural resources and selling your own raw material to have added value to them yourself, and then start exporting them.
That's
the side effect. I mean, in that book, Richard Nephew misses this point, that when you sanction a nation, especially a nation that relies on natural resources like Iran, you actually are leading that nation or forcing that nation towards another path of self-sufficiency.
Yes.
And that would increase the level of industries that are based on knowledge and science.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
In terms of the vaccination and the healthcare, Iran is the first in the region.
Yeah.
even so many other countries migrate to Iran.
And it is from the point that we would import doctors yes. from India and Pakistan.
Yes, before Inqalab and the Philippines and the India, most of the doctors in the neighborhoods were from India. But
now I've seen hospitals in Shiraz that are specifically made for, they call it medical tourism, something
yeah,
like
yeah.
this.
Yeah, Mediterranean, that's right. Mediterranean,
from,
yes.
From
okay.
Arab countries, from even other countries, they come here for different procedures, and they go out very successful.
Brain surgery, you know, is one of the most sophisticated and transplant, Professor Sami, you know, the mastermind is over there. Okay. So, Sister Zainab, as a non-Iranian, how do you find these scientific developments under sanctions? So, you when you were in Australia, okay, so how did you find it? Did you hear anything about Iran being, for example, developed this much or not?
Well, one of the first things that probably opened my eyes to Iran was actually reading about the resistance economy. I remember actually writing a sort of article, a sort of short paper about that for a sort of an online course I was taking, and that's so. And I actually, back then, I sort of developed the opinion, well, you know, in a sense, as Shay said, sanctions would actually be good for many countries. For example, I was just thinking of neighboring Iraq, which is in a very different position, which is not self-sufficient and sadly imports a lot. But it really does sort of push a country, challenges, push countries, push people towards growth, towards development. So, yeah, so this is one of the things that really fascinated me. And obviously, so I came to Iran, so I'm here.
That's right, okay. So most of the gynecologists in Iran are now women.
Yes, that's
And this
thing.
Is a good news for the women, okay?
Yes, they feel safer.
Yeah, they feel safer to go to a Muslim woman, a Muslim going to a Muslim woman who's doctor in different fields, for example, sonography, mammography, or something like that, okay, done by a lady in Iran. Not only, you know, so many ladies are doing surgery now, heart surgery, brain surgery in Iran, you know. So not only in Iran, all across the world. They're invited by the big universities all across the world in order to go.
They hold
have
positions.
Teaching courses.
They have positions in administration level. Mm-hmm. One of the martyrs in the 12-day war was a lady who was the district manager of the electricity of Tehran.
Yes.
And then when the news...
Tavanir.
Her martyrdom, people in the West said, well, you did not know ladies can have jobs in Iran. You know, that is some level of stupidity that exists in average some of them.
Let me check out her name. Neda Rafi'i.
Yes.
Neda Rafi'i Parsa, that's right.
So this is something...
Yeah, she was a university professor. She was one of the district managers, as you said, of Shirkat Tavanir, which is the main electricity one in Iran. She was a mastermind.
This is something that you do not see in the depiction of Iran. Actually, I was tour guide for some time when I was younger. And something that I would hear from the tourist, Western European tourists, always was that this is completely against our expectation. What we see in Tehran, infrastructure and the highways and the cars and everything. Because the picture that we saw from Iran in the movies was a desert, some people living like in shabby places. And what we were astonished to see that, no, Iranians, they have subways. And it's much cleaner than the subways of New York, for example. Or they have. So you see, part of this thing to create a mentality.
Yes.
And they actually, the Western media, tried so hard to keep the people of the West away from realities. For example, and it's not just with Iran, with China, with Mexico, with the nations that are not in line with Western interests. In their movies, you always have these filters of being gray and dusty, and or China... Before the social media and before the time that we see some of the infrastructure in China, if you go to Hollywood movies, China is a place of like some rural areas.
Dragons and big planets, that's right. And Bruce Lee.
They have these mythical depictions of other countries.
Martial arts.
For example, Iranians are good with the carpet and the cats.
And pistachio and saffron and caviar and everything that they have in the breakfast table.
Yeah, it's
that's like
a museum-like country, not good for modern industrialization. But then you go, and these tourists would say that when we came to Iran, we realized that, no, these people are making progress despite our unawareness of what is really going on underground here.
So many people from West and the region come to Iran in order to go to an institute called the Royan Institute. This Royan Institute, which was established by Jihad Danishgahi, Academy Jihad or something like that, is now among the toppest centers in the region and the world whose specialization is treatments for infertility. You know... And this is really...
And you know the impact that it has for the...
For IVF, that's right.
For the couples that are on the brink of separation, but they can restore...
Yeah, restore their family ties. That's it. What else? So this is your final remarks.
Yeah, so I was just thinking, yes, I found a lovely, just lovely statement from the... This is Iran's deputy permanent representative to the UN this year at the UN Commission on Status of Women. She was saying, her name is Zahra Ershadi, she was saying Iranian women continue to drive progress despite the detrimental impact of the unilateral coercive measures. And then she sort of gave just some data, which I thought were quite nice, so that women are now 33% of sort of university faculties. They're 40% of medical science professionals, over 50% of healthcare workers, 40% of specialist doctors, 45% of the public sector workforce, and 74% of the private sector employees. And over 190 women have been appointed to managerial positions nationwide. And these are these would be quite senior posts, these managerial positions.
That's right.
And women own 32,000 businesses here in Iran. So this is quite impressive.
Lots of startups, lots of business trades. That's right. That's right. Infant mortality, you know, has fallen dramatically from 100 per 1,000 to less than 10. Birth, as the recent report says, medical tourism is over there. 90% of the essential medical needs are produced domestically in Iran, okay? And you know that medication and medicine is an important part of the life that people nowadays...
It's strategically important.
Yeah, strategically important. That's right. Okay. And the COVID-19 vaccination production was the prime example of, this mass-populated domestic vaccination in Iran. That's right. Thank you. Thank you very much, Sheikh Hossein Latifi. I'm really proud to be an Iranian, to live in Iran, to this land. Very proud to have such a leader, such a system. And the true meaning of the independence is showing itself nowadays in every aspect of the life of the people. We are under sanctions. There is pressure over there. There is hardship, But inshallah, we'll pass this phase. Thank you much, both of you.
Thank you.
And thank you much, dear listeners, for being with us. Please, for more information, visit our website, iranradio.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
I know that you could easily take away everything you've given me. And I try to remember not to take anything for granted. 'Cause I know that one day, suddenly this will all come to an end. So my last wish is for you to be pleased with me. I've trusted you a thousand times, but you always bring me back to the same place. My heart is moaning, but you can't hear. What do you care about me except my face? You think you know everything? You think you're enough? But sometimes a tiny virus ruins your life. You have so many heroes, but only in movies. I've tried all you said.
On September 22, 1980, when the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people was not yet 2 years old, Saddam attacked Iran with the green light from the U.S. The former Iraqi dictator has signed a peace agreement with Mohammad Reza Pahlavi 5 years earlier, which had ended his border disputes with Iran. But just a few days before issuing the order to attack, much like the U.S. president who tore up the JCPOA agreement, he appeared openly and confidently on television and declared all his commitments with Iran null and void. Forty-five years later, with a 12-day imposed war, all these memories were revived for Iranians. This time, with America's green light, Benjamin Netanyahu, instead of Saddam, attacked Iran at a moment when indirect negotiations between Tehran and Washington were underway to supposedly resolve Iran's nuclear file peacefully. Now the entire world was waiting to see whether, just as Iranians under the guidance of their leader in the 8-year war with Saddam managed to force the enemy into accepting a ceasefire and defeat, in the second imposed war, the Israeli regime and its supporters would also be compelled to retreat or not. Contrary to its aspirations, the Israeli regime is not a major naval or land power, and all of its military capability lies in air superiority, reliant on the support of the United States and NATO. It was this capability that Israel emerged victorious in the major wars of 1967 and 1973. Yet, war planners knew that with traditional methods, an attack on Iran would not be possible. Iran shares no land border with this regime, and the distance to its sensitive and strategic points lies beyond the flight range of Israeli warplanes without aerial refueling. For this reason, airstrikes of the kind carried out in Gaza, Lebanon, and Syria are beyond the capacity of the Israeli Air Force. Thus, in the recent imposed war, the Israeli regime once again resorted to its old and once successful tactic of blitzkrieg, this time adapted to the conditions of the modern era and drawing on experiences from Syria and the war in Ukraine. The term Blitzkrieg itself entered the military vocabulary back during the Second World War, at the time when the Nazis decided to settle the fate of Europe. Hitler had many options, one of which was Blitzkrieg at the start of his invasion of France. At that time, France was considered one of the largest armies in the world, and in a conventional war, could have stopped the Nazi war machine. But but that did not happen. The Germans, not aiming merely to defeat France, but to collapse its army, government, and national morale, and launched a surprise attack that later came to be known as Blitzkrieg. In this way, Paris accepted unconditional defeat within 12 days and remained under the boots of the Nazi soldiers until the end of the war. The Zionist regime, using the name Blitzkrieg method, managed to win the battlefield in just 6 days in 1967. For this reason, in attacking Iran with the approval, coordination, and support of the White House, it chose the same method. But carrying out this operation, in addition to military and security preparations, also required other preliminaries similar to what Rafael Grossi carried out. According to the plan devised by America and Israel, Grossi was supposed to frighten Western public opinion with reports so that everything would be prepared for major war against Iran. That is exactly what happened. Rafael Grossi betraying the legitimate and legal rights of the Iranian people while accusing the Islamic Republic of nuclear evasion and concealment provided the groundwork and pretext for the aggression of the Israeli regime and the U.S. against Iran. The regime's next plot was Donald Trump's negotiation game. In this design, the White House, knowing that in the midst of negotiations, no one expects a full-scale battle, try to lower the level of Iranian readiness to confront the aggression of the Israeli regime. Interestingly, to make the deception even greater, June 15th, just 2 days after Israel's attack, was set as a date for a new round of indirect negotiations between Iran and the United States, mediated by Oman.
پیشنهادات و راهکارها ارائه بدن و بعد دور بعدی مذاکرات تنظیم بشه و
What's happening now to Syria or what's happened to Syria over the past year and a half is what the Israelis would like to do to Iran. They want to fracture their neighbors, break them apart if possible. So that's how you deal with Egypt and Jordan. And with countries like Syria, countries like Lebanon, countries like Iran, countries like Iraq, the basic goal there is to wreck those countries, to break them apart, to make them dysfunctional. And that's the second goal. That's the regime change goal when you dig down deep.
The Israeli regime's assessment was that, given Iran's chronic economic problems and social divisions, after a lightning military strike, spontaneous protest cells would emerge, and what happened in Syria would be repeated in Iran as well. Thus, it was that June 13th marked the beginning of a difficult time for Iranians. With the multi-layer hacking of the integrated air defense system and targeting of warning radars, the first challenge to the security of Iran's skies emerged. Within a short time, the path was opened for heavy air-launched projectiles to enter Iran's airspace so that, in the most severe manner possible, both the country's high-level military command structure would be destroyed through the assassination of commanders, and Iran's valuable assets in the nuclear and defense industries would be eliminated. The commanders whom the Israeli regime assassinated at dawn on June 13th were the very ones who were supposed to direct the war. Commander Bagheri, Commander Rashid, Commander Salami, and Commander Hajizadeh. The scientists who were assassinated were Dr. Abbasi, Dr. Tehranchi, Dr. Ferhi, Dr. Zulfaghari, and Dr. Manoucher, all distinguished professors at Iran's top universities in nuclear fields. The assassination of nuclear scientists, like that of military commanders, was repeated several more times until the end of the war, and in total, during the 12-day imposed war, the Israeli regime robbed Iran's scientific community of 13 prominent nuclear professors. In the course of these assassinations of commanders and scientists, many innocent citizens living in their neighborhoods, as well as members of their families, were also martyred. According to the planners of this attack, with the assassination of high-ranking generals, the situation in Iran would become so chaotic that hired groups and counter-revolutionaries could seize control of parts of Tehran, such as Mehrabad Airport and its surrounding areas, from the police and security forces. This was deemed to cause the conditions through street chaos. Special forces would be airlifted into Iran, pushing the structure of Iran's government to the brink of collapse within a matter of days. Although the blows delivered at dawn on June 13th would have been enough to bring about the collapse of the governments of many powerful countries in the world, this did not happen in Iran. In the very first hours after the attack, the leader of the revolution, through a message, illuminated the path of resistance for the Iranian nation. Despite security threats, he maintained this line of communication with the people and officials throughout the 12 days of war, so that while directly managing the battle, the necessary measures could be taken based on the realities of the field. The presence of the commander-in-chief during the 12-day war once again proved his role in restoring psychological calm to society and preserving the cohesion and organization of the armed forces in defending the country. The peak of this unique role was in appointing senior military commanders as replacements for the martyrs who had been assassinated by the Israeli regime. On the afternoon of the first day of the war, the leader of the Islamic Revolution once again addressed the people in a televised message. In the past, it had been proven many times that Iran, through its missile industry, possesses both the capability and the will to punish its enemies, especially the Israeli regime. For this reason, Iran's missile response was the most predictable action of the Islamic Republic, and naturally, Israel had devised what it thought were countermeasures for it. According to their plan, in the very first moments of June 13th, the commanders and missile bases of the IRGC were supposed to come under fire. With extensive propaganda and the wide circulation of images showing the destruction of missile launchers on June 13th, many were led to believe that Iran no longer had the ability to respond with missiles. Launch of dozens of older generation IRGC drones before noon that same day could also have made these illusions seem real. But shortly afterward, following the televised message of the leader of the revolution to the people, the first wave of Iranian missile launches began, plunging the West into an intelligence shock. The name of this operation had already been determined, True Promise 3. In line with operations True Promise 1 and 2, the IRGC in its first missile response did exactly what the regime had anticipated, using a large number of missiles so that the Israelis would feel assured that Iran's missile response pattern had not changed. The Israeli army assumed that by Iran's numerous launches, the locations of its missile systems would be exposed, and subsequently, under aerial strikes, another portion of the Islamic Republic's missile capability could be destroyed.
Country in the world that believes that when they just go out and start bombing civilians, that that's called self-defense. It's absurd. So Iran didn't waste any time. They have retaliated within about less than 24 hours, and they've hit Israel and Tel Aviv and other sites throughout Israel. The Israeli government's going to great lengths to cover that up and pretend, oh, nothing happened here.
Israel suffered massive losses, many direct hits in Haifa, in Beersheba, in Tel Aviv, the Iron Dome, and the other parts of the system, because that's just one component of Israel's air defense system, failed on multiple occasions. Iran has missiles that can penetrate Israel's air defenses.
A large number of missiles, drones, and ballistic and cruise missiles launched in Iran's first response was observed. The armed forces of the Islamic Republic updated their information on the regime's defensive layers. After that, contrary to the enemy's expectations, the number of missiles decreased. This was the second stage of deceiving the Israeli army, because the other side assumed that the missile stockpiles of the Islamic Republic of Iran had been severely reduced. Now, it was time to carry out the next stage of Iran's new missile tactics. At this stage, while launching small waves of missiles at different times, the number of operations increased. Gradually, unlike the hours of night and darkness, launches were carried out during the day and under the bright sky, the very sky over which the Zionists and America claim to have dominance.
How badly was the Israeli defense industry in Israel damaged by the retaliation from the Iranian missiles? Do we know?
No, we don't have any details. There's no question that a number of sites were hit. Air bases were hit, research institutions were hit. They ran out of defensive, or they were running out of defensive missiles, as we know. So damage was done, and of course damage was done to all sorts of buildings, both military buildings and civilian buildings inside of Tel Aviv. And then in Haifa, they hit the port. They did enormous damage to the one of the two oil refineries that the Israelis have. So they did, the Iranians did an enormous amount of damage inside of Israel. But
Israel thought, A, that this war would be short,